ShareCare, helping you find experts, the top minds in health and medicine. It's ShareCare Radio with Dr. Daria Long Gillespie on RadioMD.com.
Hello and welcome to ShareCare Radio. It's Dr. Daria here. Remember, if you miss any of our segments today or just want to catch an additional point, go to sharecare.com/radioMD to find everything. You can always also go to just sharecare.com for comprehensive health information and your own health profile. But for now, let's just dive into the news of the week. First one is about sugary drinks. Again, we've been hearing a lot about the impact of sugar, sugary drinks, and even some areas where they're trying to restrict how much people can drink. And this is a new study, a new research looking at the association between the consumption of sugary drinks and death. Even. And this study showed that the consumption of sugary drinks may lead to an approximate 180,000 adult deaths every year worldwide. Now, researchers calculated the direct impact of the sugar load and obesity on diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and cancer. They looked at about 62 dietary surveys that included 600,000 people between the 1980s to 2010 in 51 countries. So very, very comprehensive. Now, the U.S. ranked the second highest death rate with an estimated of 125 deaths per million due to sugary drinks. And the highest was Mexico. So, you know, we see a lot of things about a country's mortality and life expectancy in the U.S. And now we're seeing the impact of it just due to sugary drinks is a contributor. So again, the percent of chronic disease attributed to sugar drinks was even higher in younger adults than older adults. The key takeaway is that all of these sugary drinks that we're drinking and all the sugar in general, that is leading to health impacts, diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, cancer, that can directly impact a country and a human individual's life expectancy. So we need to be considerate of that as we are consuming these things. Now, this next one was about diabetes, but it's a different twist on it. Now, these were pediatric diabetes researchers, and they found that giving a child the responsibilities of a pet could improve the child's own blood glucose levels. Now, again, according to the CDC, about 1.25 million American children and adults have type 1 diabetes, and it counts for about 5% of all diagnosed cases of diabetes and the leading cause of diabetes in children. Now, this study looked at just a small group, 28 adolescents ages 10 to 17 with type 1 diabetes. They gave each one of them a fish, a fishbowl, instructions for caring for the fish, and recommendations on how to set it up. And the kids were told to feed the fish in the morning and night, and every time they fed the fish, they were supposed to check their own blood glucose levels. They were also asked to change the water in the fishbowl once a week and review their own blood glucose logs with a guardian. Now, interestingly, after about 3 months, those kids that had a fish showed decreases in their HbA1c levels, or a marker of how well they're keeping their blood glucose under control, compared to kids that had no fish at all. So what's the key takeaway? It probably doesn't matter if it's a fish or a dog or a cat or a pet hamster. What seemed to have been the biggest issue is that each of these children were given a routine, and it was responsibility for caregiving for another. And having that routine plus the support of their guardian significantly improved their diabetes and glucose level. So always something to consider for a child that may not be wanting to pay attention to their diabetes, but if they think it matters for their fish or somebody else's responsibility for somebody else, may actually have a better chance of getting through to them and helping them keep on top of their diabetes. Now, this other study, okay, as a mother of a 17-month-old, you can be certain that I was reading this and applying this last night, actually. Now, this was for parents to promote healthier eating habits in their kids. They said there are three steps. There are the three R's, repetition, role modeling, and rewards, to get your child to be less of a picky eater. And they said, now, what did all those mean? The repetition means you continuously and frequently expose a child to a specific food. So, you know, many studies have shown if your child refuses a food or refuses broccoli or beans the first time or the third or the fourth time, keep offering it to them. Don't give up. It can often take more than 10 times and 10 to 15 times for a child to see a food and maybe try it before they actually eat it or even like it at all. So it's repetition. Number two, the second R is role modeling. So eating it yourself, showing them how delicious it is. And third is rewards. Now, this is a tricky one. You want to praise them for trying it. You don't want to offer a reward like, you know, eat this broccoli and then you can have a cupcake, because then the child really starts to see the broccoli as a work and the cupcake as a reward. So you don't want to do that. But you want to praise them for trying it and being adventurous. All of those are three ways that you can really positively impact your child's attitude towards new food. So they did this in a study, and they looked at 115 children between the ages of 2 and 4, that really challenging age that refuses to eat anything. They were placed in 4 different groups with different food intervention techniques, and they're given the same vegetable to taste every day for 14 days. They then measured the amount of vegetables eaten at the end of the study. Now, the group of children introduced to the 3 R's showed significantly more veggies eaten and even liked them more. So they ate them more and they liked eating it more. So what's a key takeaway? If you're having a child who's refusing some foods, remember the key R's: repetition, aka don't give up; role modeling, as in let your child see you eat it and like it; and 3, reward them in that you're praising them for being adventurous. We had this happen last night. We finally broke through with my toddler to eat salmon. She would not eat salmon for maybe the 5th time we tried it last night. Still refused to eat it. Then I sat down and I ate it too. And then I praised her for eating it. So we got all 3 R's in there, and I finally have a child that likes salmon, but it only took several weeks. So again, parents, remember, you got to keep persisting, and you will have a child that will eat adventurously and healthy. Now, going on an entirely different note, you know, you hear me talk a lot about take a break, go for a walk, just go clear your head a little bit. Now, this study looked at the impact of your environment. Now, it looked at the wild environment or being out in nature and how that could help you by reducing kind of obsessive negative thoughts. It was from scientists at Stanford, and they looked at the impacts of a nature walk. They chose city inhabitants living in a really urban area because they thought the areas like that often have higher levels of chronic stressors, the urban lifestyle, louder noise. Now, half the participants walked through grassland with oak trees and shrubs for 90 minutes, so a pretty long time, while the other half walked along a 4-lane street with heavy traffic. Now, of course, you probably don't need me to tell you that one was less stressful than the other. But they actually showed that those who were walking in nature had decreases in rumination, which means they less of that going back and forth about negative thoughts and questions, and especially less activity in the part of the brain associated with negative thoughts, while the urban walkers showed no improvements. So what's a key takeaway is that, you know, going for a walk is good for all of us. And if the only place you can walk is in the along the side of the street, I will still tell you to go for a walk because there are many benefits to going for a walk. But to have the greatest benefit, if you can go for someplace that's a little bit quieter, a little bit away from it all, you're going to have the biggest benefit in terms of health and in just mental well-being. Now, you know, earlier I was talking about sugar consumption and the impact. This latest study talked about how in the U.S., 50% of deaths from heart disease among adults 45 to 79 are preventable. Now, these preventable risk factors are accounting for such a high percentage of cardiovascular deaths. And remember, heart disease is the leading cause of death in the U.S. It causes 1 out of every 4 deaths, or 610,000 deaths every year, according to the CDC. Now, how'd they do this? They asked over 500,000 people a phone-based risk factor survey between 2009 and 2010. And they concluded that had it been possible to eliminate every case of high cholesterol, high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, and smoking in the U.S., 54% of heart disease deaths among men and 50% of heart disease deaths among women in 2010 could have been prevented. Now, remember, smoking, obesity, diabetes, high cholesterol, these are lifestyle factors that we have a huge impact over. And if we can control them, you can control the number of deaths and just lower quality of life in general. So key takeaway, so many of the deaths from heart disease are in our own hands. We have to remember that's actually quite empowering, and remember that. So there you have it, the top health news you'll need to know for this week. For more health news throughout the week, follow me on Twitter at my handle at Dr. Daria, or go to @ShareCareInc to find out more news. You're listening to ShareCare Radio on Radio MD, also available at www.sharecare.com/radioMD. Thanks for tuning in, and stay well.